My name's Nikolai Tolstoy, and my latest book is called Stalin's Vengeance. The one before that was a two-volume biography of my stepfather, the author Patrick O'Brien, and my profession is a historian, really.
Can you tell us a bit about your education and your family background?
Yes, my family is Russian, of course, and my father escaped from Russia during the Civil War in 1920, and he came to England where he had relatives, so he was better off than most immigrants. And then I was born 15 years later and went to school in England. And I went to boarding schools and Wellington College, where I finished. Then I was going to go in the army as a regular, so I went to Sandhurst, but I got a back injury while I was there and was invalided out.
Okay, so a lot of people know the name Tolstoy. Is there any relationship to the Russian literary family?
Oh, yes, we are. I'm the head of the family at the moment because of being the senior branch, and the famous author, well, we've had several, but the most famous one, Leo Tolstoy, was my great-grandfather's cousin.
Okay, so can you just give us your view? I suppose this is pretty much coming directly from your father. Of what went on in the Russian Revolution, because I think, you know, for many people growing up after World War II, for example, a lot of that seemed to get forgotten. So what was all about the getting rid of the Tsars, and what do you understand was really taking place there with the benefit of hindsight?
Well, of course, there might well never have been a revolution, or certainly not one like the one that actually happened, but for the Great War. And it's vital to remember that this happened during a long and bloody war in which the Russian armies suffered huge losses. And in fact, the revolution, it wasn't the revolution that overthrew Nicholas II, the Tsar, but it was the loss of confidence of his generals who finally, though they were loyal enough, but they said, well, must have to abdicate. And they felt they would then be able to pursue the war more effectively. But actually, it made no difference. If anything, things were better run marginally under the Tsar. So then there was a long period. There were two revolutions. The first one, not so much the abdication of the Tsar, but the establishment of a Russian Republic, sort of liberal democratic republic, but that wasn't able to handle the war. Discipline broke down, and by the end of 1917, the Bolsheviks took over in a coup simultaneously in Moscow and Petrograd, as St. Petersburg was named then. And then the civil war broke out with the whites wanting to overthrow the Bolsheviks and call an election, and the Bolsheviks determined not to have an election, nationwide election. And so the civil war then broke out between the Reds and the Whites, which lasted for roughly 3 years. But my father didn't play any part in that because he was only a boy. But at our estate, which was in Eastern European Russia, near Kazan, my grandfather had gone off to fight, so there were mostly just the women left behind, and my father had an English nanny, and that was very normal in Russian households to have either a Scottish or English nanny. And she was a wonderful woman called Lucy Stark, and she, although I've written a book about my family, and in that I describe adventures, and after hair-raising adventures, which...
Well, can you just give us the... Sorry, Nikolai, can you just give us the title of the book?
It's called The Tolstoys. Okay. And it's a chapter-by-chapter history of more famous members of the family. And the last chapter is about what happened to my father and how he escaped from Russia. But in one sentence, Lucy, the governess, pretended he was her illegitimate son. And when the British and the Soviets signed a treaty at Copenhagen, it included mutual repatriation. So she smuggled him out, and so they got to, she was British, of course. So she had a passport, and they came to Britain and had friends and relations here. And so, well, it affected him all his life. It made him very horrible, but horrible for millions of people.
One of the main problems for Russia was the revolution seemed to be hatched in Switzerland. The people who were actually carrying out the revolution, many people now looking at this will think, well, these people, Lenin, etc., the Bolsheviks seem to have been trained for this job over in Switzerland. Is that true, do you think?
Yes, it is largely true, in that Lenin and Trotsky were exiles in, Trotsky wasn't at this stage, but Lenin was an exile in Switzerland, exiled by the imperial government. And it was during the war, the German government decided that to break up Russia and halt the war on the Eastern Front so they could deal with the French and the British without any war on the Eastern Front. The Germans paid and arranged for Lenin to be smuggled through neutral Sweden into Russia. And thereafter, the Germans paid colossal sums secretly to the Bolsheviks, who were completely dependent for their success on German money. And evidence of that has increased over the years. And recently a colleague of mine in America has published a book, perhaps 2 or 3 years ago, on the revolution. And he documents even more fully than previous historians the extent to which the Germans funded the Bolsheviks.
Sorry, Nikolai, again, I want to interrupt you, because if you can recall it, it'd be really good to have the title of the book and the author there.
Oh, yes, he's called Sean McMeekin, McMeekin. And it's called, if you want the exact title, I can get it from the book. Oh, yes, it's very simple. It's called The Russian Revolution. And I recommend it as the best book that I've read and I've read a lot on the revolution.
OK, so your own work recently has been looking at more at the Second World War and the aftermath of it. Is there anything you want to say about the role of the Russians in the Second World War, particularly the sort of shilly-shallying that went on beforehand with the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact and then the invasion of Barbarossa? Because it seemed that there was this, and in fact, I think it's Alan Bullock that wrote this book, Hitler and Stalin, Parallel Lives, which did a lot to sort of compare Hitler and Stalin to each other, saying actually there was a lot of similarities between the two, certainly in the run-up to World War II. And it'd be interesting to see what you make of Alan Bullock's work and if you think it's fair to compare them.
I think it's more than fair to compare them. I suppose the one difference is probably that Stalin killed far more people even than Hitler. But really, I would say they were equal in evil and in their evil deeds. And indeed, what is often forgotten is that for nearly the first 2 years of the last war, Hitler and Stalin were warm allies, divided up Eastern Europe between them. Stalin was only too keen to he didn't break down the alliance. It was Hitler, of course, who did with Operation Barbarossa in 1941. And he then turned on, foolishly as it turned out, turned on Stalin, who was absolutely petrified and dismissed people who reported that German naval vessels were bombarding Odessa, that the Luftwaffe was knocked out virtually all warplanes on Stalin's east-western front. And Stalin just refused to, he couldn't believe it. He couldn't believe it because he just seems to have panicked utterly at the thought of being betrayed by his great ally. So he didn't go willingly to war against Hitler. And that's something which is completely misrepresented, partly because
you're saying there that Stalin killed more people than Hitler, even within his own country. For many young people today, they will be amazed to hear that, Nikolai. So could you just talk a little bit about Stalin and what was he doing? Why was he killing so many of his fellow countrymen? What was the motive? What was the result?
Well, the Bolsheviks relied openly, or at least openly in their discussions amongst each other, on terror, as they proudly called it, from the very beginning. And Trotsky was just as appalling. That he fell out with Stalin, gave him some sort of cachet in the West. But there was no question he was just as cruel and brutal. So they relied on terror throughout. And then with Stalin, the terror became, it was, of course, enormously increased. There was the forced famine in the Ukraine, which contrasts, incidentally, very interestingly, with the Russian imperial government. In 1891, there was a colossal famine in Russia, which the Russian government hadn't the resources. Well, it did cope to the best it could, but nevertheless, it was very hard to manage. But all research shows that the Russian imperial government was desperate to help the victims of the famine. When it came to communism, Stalin created the famine by refusing to allow grain into Ukraine and robbing the peasants of the kulaks, as he called them, of their grain stores. So he really made war against his own people, and that shouldn't be forgotten.
Okay, so what about the why? What was Stalin up to? Where were these people dying? Who was dying? And what was the purpose of it all?
Well, there were successive purposes. The main purpose was simply to terrorize the whole population. And, of course, it was a system that sort of devoured itself, because for every person sent off to the colossal slave labor system of slave labor camps, partly because Russia was so huge, he could hide this to some extent from the West. So people, everyone had relations who were in the slave labor camps. Also, slavery in Russia, in Soviet Russia, was distinct from the sort of slavery we hear a lot about nowadays in the West Indies and southern states of America, in that cruel though they clearly were, the slave drivers of Negroes had an interest in keeping them alive and healthy. Doesn't mean to say they always followed that sensible rule. In Stalin, it was quite different. He actually wished to work them to death. And much of the work was complete. If you read the memoirs of people who were in these slave camps, much of the work was completely pointless. And the death rate was appalling and continual.
And really, what about the suppression of religion? Because I know that was a large part of this Bolshevik idea as well.
Yes, it was. It was fundamental to Bolshevism to try to destroy religion. And all over Russia, hundreds of thousands of beautiful, setting aside the Christian and Christianity, these beautiful churches were destroyed right across Russia. The destruction was terrible. And symbol of the resurrection of Russia, we don't know how long that will last, was that the main cathedral, very fine one, which was built by public subscription in Moscow, was blown up by Stalin and utterly destroyed. But when the communism collapsed in 1990, the government set to work and has completely rebuilt the cathedral exactly as it was before. So some good has been happening lately.
And what about the armed forces? What happened there? I also understand that there was Stalin had decided that some types of officers had to go, others, you know, were promoted, etc.
Yes, in the 1930s, Stalin purged the Red Army. He was terrified of a coup by the Red Army. And like many half-educated people, which is what he was, organization in the country which could do anything about overthrowing the regime, obviously, were the armed forces. So they had to be guarded against more than anyone. And Stalin didn't trust them. And there were the famous show trials when Marshal Tukhachevsky, who was undoubtedly his ablest commanding officer, they were taken and tortured until they confessed to imaginary crimes and then secretly executed. Executed in prison where no one could see what was happening. and torture was used as normally throughout the whole country. With all its faults, the previous regime had a proper legal system with appeals and so on, and verdicts were quite often found in important cases against what the government might have wished. That couldn't happen in the Soviet Union. It was, and of course, the other horrible thing is that having inflicted all this on Russia, it was fear of communism in Europe, which largely resulted in Hitler's rise to power in Germany. It wouldn't have happened but for Stalin's existence. And of course, even more closely cause and effect was the creation of what now threatens the entire world, Chinese communism.
And it's a sort of a shorthand, but it's easier to remember when you think that the Russian Revolution happened in the time of the First World War and the Chinese just after the Second World War. But look, going back to, I love these comparisons between Stalin and Hitler, and you have actually, you're starting to make me wonder whether Stalin may have been even worse. Both of them quite clearly had in their minds concentration camps, death camps, labor camps, whatever you want to call them. And I wonder how extensive this network was in Stalin's Russia, and actually what was the death toll?
We don't know. There's still no certain figures. It undoubtedly runs into tens of millions. Better statistics are now, since the archives were opened and the records of Gulag, we're getting much more factual statistical information. What we had before, thanks to Solzhenitsyn, but also to many survivors before who wrote published memoirs in the West, we did know how horrific the conditions were, but didn't have statistics. Those are gradually emerging, slowly, but the numbers certainly run into millions. And also there were the purges, as I say, the forced famine. But during the time of Hitler's alliance with Stalin, there was, I think this answers your question in a particularly sinister way, that Stalin and Hitler exchanged political prisoners. Hitler held a whole lot of communists who'd be put in prison, and Stalin held communist refugee, German communists who'd fled to the Soviet Union. They did a neat exchange at the town of Brest-Litovsk on the border, and they were then sent to their respective enemies' labor camps or extermination camps.
So can you just give us your picture of the way that the Second World War unfolded, with the Russians coming into the war, quickly followed by the United States, and then ultimately to Germany's defeat?
Yes. Well, I should say that I did write a book on this some years ago called Stalin's Secret War, in which I go into what I'm talking about in obviously much more detail. And my friend, colleague, Sean McMeekin's book carries the story still further. But the evidence that comes out is just confirms the horrors more and more. There isn't a sudden discovery that it wasn't as bad as we thought. It's, if anything, worse. But of course, the moment Hitler attacked Stalin, Stalin had no choice but to resist. But enormous losses were incurred as a result of his allowing himself to be duped by Hitler because of the speed of the German advance, and also that enabled the SS to liquidate vast numbers of people suspected of being resistance, and also people who, whether they resisted or not, were Jews who were slaughtered in vast numbers by the German army, but nevertheless it did happen. But of course, behind the lines, in the hands of the SS. So the losses there were absolutely huge. Stalin himself had, behind every Red Army unit was an NKVD, secret police, sort of paramilitary police operating, killing deserters. Anyone who surrendered, Stalin's, I forget the number of the order, notorious order that every Russian soldier, Soviet soldier, must keep one bullet in his rifle to kill himself. They must not surrender. But so incompetent was the initial conduct of the war on the Soviet side, and also the devastation caused by the surprise owing to the Hitler-Stalin pact, that huge numbers, hundreds of thousands of, indeed millions, of Red Army troops fell into German hands. And there again, Stalin must bear the responsibility for this. These died in droves under inhuman, as a result of inhuman treatment by the Nazis in the prisoner of war camps. Stalin had refused to sign the Geneva Convention on prisoners of war, so Russian prisoners had no protection. They were abandoned, whereas British, French and Americans, they were, the Germans on the whole respected the Geneva Convention, speaking broadly, with the Western allies, and didn't need to respect it on the. So that again, all these people who died must have been placed in the responsibility of Stalin as much as of Hitler.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, okay. The Russian people. Sorry.
I mean, let's not forget the White Russians, because they were, basically still very resentful of the way they've been treated in the interwar period. And as I understand it, I was chatting with a son of a Nazi scientist, Manfred Petrisch, a few years ago, and he was telling me that actually they had even an armoured division which was fully made up of White Russians fighting on the Eastern Front for the Nazis.
There was more than a division. What happened was that Hitler would never trust Russians. Anyway, he believed they were racially inferior, so he wouldn't have. But many sensible German officers were saying, look, we've got all these millions of Russians who hate communism. We ought to be making use of them. Well, when the war was obviously going so badly that even Hitler had to pay attention, they then raised a anti-Soviet army among the Russians. They were told they were going to be allowed to fight. And I think about a Red Army general who'd been captured, surrendered to the Germans, but who saw the horrors of Stalinism. General Vlasov was appointed nominal chief. And I think at its height, it had about 800,000 or 900,000 troops. And the Solzhenitsyn said, there's unparalleled in history that you could get such a proportion of people willing and eager to fight against the regime of their own country.
That sounds like a massive unit of some sort. That sounds like an army rather than a corps or a division.
It was a whole army, really, with divisions. But yeah. They're only in the very last throes of the war were they allowed to fight, and they did fight very bravely. And Solzhenitsyn, at one point when he was a young officer, he attested to, he came into conflict with them when he was serving in the Red Army, and how bravely they fought. And all this speaks legions for the horrors of the regime that could give so many people. Most of them, of course, being a fighting age, could not remember pre-revolutionary Russia. The average soldier was going to be in his 20s. So they and so all they knew was the Soviet Union, and all they knew was how their relations had been taken away, murdered, enslaved. So Stalin, again, this was his responsibility. Obviously, it prolonged the war.
One of the other things Manfred told me was that one of the generals from one of these armored divisions with its panzer tanks that had been fighting on the Eastern Front at the end of the war drove with his mechanized unit down to the Swiss border where he challenged the Swiss, and he told them, well, look, either you pay us X amount of money, which would be quite a lot, or else we're going to attack you. And the Swiss negotiated after a few days, they agreed to pay them. And then they handed all their equipment over once they got the money and went off into the sunset rather satisfied. So it does seem as if this was a side of the war which wasn't really talked about much. But you've just done your book about Stalin, haven't you? And also about Harold Macmillan, which I think very few people, even who can remember the older ones of Macmillan being prime minister here, that he was involved in this rather a lot of skullduggery in Austria right at the end of the Second World War. So can you just take us through that story briefly?
Yes, among the Russian people who were the most opposed to the regime were the Cossacks, who had been very hideously persecuted under the Stalinist regime. And they, when the German army occupied Cossack territory in the, on the River Don, they were greeted as liberators.
And okay, of course, so, we have a picture of a Cossack, most people do in their mind, with a bushy black hat on. Who were the Cossacks?
Well, they weren't a particular race. They were people originally on the borderland between in what's now Ukraine and further east, who, when Russia and the Russian Empire and the Turkish Empire were opposed to each other, these were Christians, the Cossacks, so they were on the Russian side. They were mostly of Russian and Polish origin, but they built up their own traditions and were very independent-minded and valued their freedom, which had been denied them. So the Germans raised Cossack units, allowed them to wear their proper Cossack uniforms, they could use their own forms of command, and they were very brave. They did fight, but they weren't allowed to fight against the Red Army because Stalin was frightened. He always said that one a Russian will always back another Russian. So they were sent as a sop to Yugoslavia to fight against Tito and his communists. But that, and they fought there very toughly. I met many German officers who served with them. Then at the end of the war, they realized that they would be obviously be killed by Tito or Stalin, whoever got hold of them. So they fought their way out into British-occupied Austria, the British having just arrived from North Italy. And there they were put into camps. They were very well treated. The British were sympathetic to them. I mean, not they weren't interested in their military aspect, but they were, because they were also accompanied by about 11,000 old men, women, and children. They had their families with them. So they were put into evacuated German barracks where they were well treated, but and it's very difficult in my book. I go have to go into this in detail to show what happened, but in very brief summary, nobody on the Allied side, except Macmillan, considered handing these people over, betraying them to hand them over to the Soviets. Field Marshal Alexander, the Allied commander in the Mediterranean, said famously, to do so would be fatal to their health. And what happened was, and which is very little known, but it is all set out in my new book, that Field Marshal Alexander, the moment he learned of the presence of these Cossacks, he immediately sent messages to Churchill in London and to Eisenhower, his counterpart commanding Allied troops in occupied Germany, surrendered Germany, and said, we must, please, can you help me? I can't look after all these people. There's too many. And would Eisenhower take them in the U.S. zone? Eisenhower hesitated only because he said, I've got millions of German prisoners to look after. It's too much. But under a plea, following a plea from Alexander and from Churchill, Eisenhower agreed. And it was then, it wasn't just an agreement on paper. Eisenhower immediately got ordered General Patton, who sent two U.S. cavalry divisions, or armored divisions, plus 800 trucks for the set purpose of removing all the Cossacks to safety in the American zone of Germany. And it was this that hit, that Macmillan intervened for motives which I don't know what the motive was. All I know is what happened, not what why it happened. But Macmillan, who'd gone up to North Italy, got a message from the British commander in Austria telling him about the Cossacks, and also that they included an important number who were not Soviet citizens, and so not liable to be handed over. They were people who'd lived abroad since the revolution. And so Macmillan somehow persuaded, well, he had power to do so, he was the minister, political advisor to Alexander, so the not very imaginative or humane British commander, General Keighley, secretly agreed. Every order which continued to come from Alexander, saying these people are to be sent to the American zone, they're to not to be handed over unless they wish to go, all these orders were disobeyed, and the Cossacks were secretly handed over to be either murdered at once or put into slave labor camps in Siberia, where most of them, including the women and children, died in horrible conditions. And Macmillan was undoubtedly responsible. I show exactly why in my book, and new evidence has confirmed what I'd written in previous books. And I don't think in my book, there's never an end of writing about these things. New evidence always comes to light. But I would say that apart from the Macmillan's motive, which perhaps will never be known, there are no gaps in the evidence anymore. The chief reason for that is because I was invited by President Yeltsin to go to Moscow, and to he opened up all the secret archives to me, even those of the SMERSH. And I was allowed to take away photocopies of everything I wanted. And that evidence, for the first time, is now in my new book and confirms everything that I previously speculated. And incidentally, it shows that my critics, there weren't so many of them, but they were influential, were wildly wrong. So it's not a disgrace. Of course, the British obedience to orders is, as we know, because of the Nuremberg war crimes trials, it's not a defense to act inhumanely to prisoners of war, which is what the Cossacks were. And their camp followers are also protected by the Geneva Convention. So it was a brutal violation of the laws of war, for which Germans at Nuremberg, of course, who were committed similar crimes to that ordered by Macmillan, or the exact words, he issued a verbal directive, same thing. But Macmillan is still, especially in the Conservative Party, a sort of haloed saint. And the only villain in all this, in their eyes, is me for exposing it.
Yeah, interesting, isn't it? He then went on to become Prime Minister. It almost seems like a reward for doing a little dirty deed, maybe.
Well, I wouldn't say that exactly, but it certainly didn't bar him. Well, of course, but what I would say is that nobody in this country, until my first book came out, Victims of Yalta, way back in the 70s, and there was a good book by Lord Bethel too, The Last Secret. Until then, nobody even knew it had happened. It was kept an extraordinary secret that all these, well, the British and the Americans handed over altogether, setting aside the Cossacks for a moment, 2.25 million people to be butchered by Stalin. It's a crime on a level with anything committed by the Nazis, yet it's a crime that is barely known, and you even, in my case, prohibited by law from even discussing. Speaking to you, I can be sent to prison for saying what I've just said, because a court injunction says I'm not allowed to raise these issues.
Okay, could you just tell us how that happened and when, briefly?
Well, what happened was, very briefly, is that the Keighley's chief of staff, Brigadier Lowe, afterwards became Lord Aldington, he was the one who transmitted the orders, but he was a wartime soldier, but when he flew back to Britain, and he was really politically minded. He was a friend of Anthony Eden. I say weirdly because they were completely different age, class, background, everything. And when Macmillan became Prime Minister, read this as you may, he made Aldington a Lord. That's how he became Lord Aldington. I accused Lord Aldington in a pamphlet in the 1980s of being a war criminal, because what he had done would, if it had come up, been on the other side and come up at Nuremberg on trial, undoubtedly he would have been found to be a war criminal. And that I show much more clearly in on the purely legal front in my current book. And so it was, then there was a trial which lasted about 2.5 months, in which I was found to have libeled Lord Aldington. And to keep me, and above all to keep other people quiet, the damages of £1.5 million plus £500,000 costs were found against me. That was three times higher than any other libel award in the whole of English legal history. And it was obviously meant to not just to silence me, but to silence others. But it backfired, that particular ploy, because it attracted so much attention. And indeed, in the end, it was condemned by the European Court of Human Rights as infringing my democratic right to freedom of speech. So this actually helped me in a backhanded way. But it's very strange how things work out. Because I'd been fined like this and I was unable to work and I was under threat the whole time, I can't call him a friend, but a sort of collaborator, who assisted with the printing of the leaflet which caused such offence, was sent to prison for saying nothing compared with what I say now to you and what I've actually published in my book.
Well, I hope I can just set your mind at rest, because you can't libel a dead person, and Lord Aldington is dead.
Yes, so I thought, and what you say is absolutely correct. And I thought on that basis, not that it deterred me, but when he was alive. But there's something quite different, which is the injunction issued by the judge at the close of the trial, which says that I am, injunction forbids me to criticise Lord Aldington or to hold him responsible, or even to say that he did anything at that time, even though he was the chief of staff running the entire corps in his corps commander's name. So it's an absurdity. There's never been a historical event, not in British history, where you're not allowed to discuss it even. And
I just think it's a fascinating case, because quite clearly the establishment was throwing everything at you, Nicolai, at that point. Lord Aldington, he's the former chairman of Deutsche Bank in London from, is it 2002 to 2009, or maybe that's his son?
I think the bank that he ran was, wasn't it called Gridley's Bank? I don't think it was Deutsche Bank. Anyway,
Lord Aldington.
He had been chairman of the Tory party.
Oh, right. OK. And also he died in 2000. So that's probably his son. But anyway, look, getting back a bit more to the present. I mean, it's fascinating you getting the opportunity to go through the Russian archives, as several others have done over the years. It's been really interesting, obviously, opening them up after Yeltsin, or the time of Yeltsin and post Yeltsin. But what do you make of the way that Russia was so utterly stripped in the 1990s? I mean, it really was a kind of rape of a country of all of the state controlled assets by the oligarchs. Because chatting with Alex Craner, as a regular contributor to our program and a hedge fund manager, former hedge fund manager, he's a Croatian originally, but he's based in Monaco now. He says that he thinks the similar sort of thing happened with the oligarchs actually being trained up in Switzerland to go and to learn how to borrow money, to buy up, to bribe officials, to basically privatise all of the masses of Russia's state-owned industry in the 1990s.
I don't know, to be honest, I don't know anything about your last point. Obviously, it was disastrous for Russia that these awful, mostly awful, oligarchs seized hold of the Russian assets, and the state began to be more or less run in their interests. And that's very sadly what we still have with us.
Tell us what you know about that era? Because it's a pretty horrific thing for a proud nation like Russia to be effectively asset stripped.
Absolutely, you're absolutely right. But I'm not. I mean, what you say is factually correct beyond any doubt. But actually, I'm not a. I'm less interested. Well, I mean, I am interested in what's going on in Russia now, but I don't study it in the sense that I have done historical events.
Yeah, okay. So your book is called Stalin's Vengeance, The Final Truth About the Forced Return of the Cossacks After World War II by Nikolai Tolstoy. That's you. Can you just tell us why, Nikolai? Why is this still interesting for people today? Because most people would think, hey, this is all a long, long, long time ago.
It is a long time ago, but on the other hand, it's a terrible crime, a huge crime, war crime, which has never been, not only has no one been punished for it, but it's, as you can see from what I've been explaining, that it becomes forbidden to investigate it properly, or perhaps at all you can do. And so people, and one of the monstrous aspects to me, a side effect, is that because Macmillan, it's against the law to say, Aldington, it's against the law to say that he was guilty of war crimes. But still, the war crime took place. That isn't disputed. It wasn't even disputed. They didn't dare at my trial. It means, so somebody was responsible. And as we're not allowed to say it was Lord Aldington, it had to be someone else. So-called historians don't hesitate to accuse Churchill or Alexander of bearing the responsibility. So they actually will blacken their own people rather than give the game away about what, or allow the game to be given away about what happened.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, your story is a very typical of much to do with the Second World War, because Lord Aldington dying in 2000, suddenly, he cannot use the law anymore, being dead, in order to silence people like you. And the same is true of quite a lot, I think, of elderly people who knew secrets about the Second World War, who came out with their truth in a factual way. Of course, people like Fleming, etc., and Dennis Wheatley would write about this in fictional terms. In the 1960s and 70s, and did quite well in that way. But one of my little discoveries is the British relationship with Hitler's deputy Martin Bormann at the end of the war. And I wonder, do you think that the relationship between the British runs a bit deeper than that with the Nazis? Because we quite clearly, with our King Edward VIII and with people like Montague Norman helping Hitler to basically scrape out the last remnants of any kind of independent armed forces and financial power in Czechoslovakia, there seem to be actually quite a lot of links, both at the beginning of the war and before the war and at the end of the war, between the Nazis and the British.
Well, to take them, they're separate really issues, aren't they? The Duke of Windsor and other people a bit like him. To be honest, I don't hold any cards for them, but it was very peripheral and indeed rather pathetic, and they were eventually rounded up and or discredited, and the Duke had to be bundled off to govern the Bahamas. But for what happened after the war, I don't like to make judgments about things that I haven't properly researched. So quite, to be honest, I don't think there was a huge collaboration. There was some, but I think my story, or the one I've written about, is quite clearly in a league of its own, and involved hundreds of thousands of people.
Well, what I'm suggesting, Nikolai, really, is that it goes a little bit beyond that, because towards the end of the war, there were some common interests between the British, the Americans and the Nazis. And the result of that was the Cold War. That there was this kind of continued, even going right back to Napoleonic times, this kind of Russophobia seemed to take hold again.
Well, I mean, it was justified. I don't justify Russophobia because I'm Russian, but the Soviets did represent a very potent threat. We had nothing we could do except, I mean, there, Stalin on two separate occasions summoned the leaders of the Warsaw Pact to Moscow and told them we're now going to go to war and overrun Western Europe. And he was only dissuaded by the even the subservient puppet leaders that the West would unleash nuclear war and probably destroy the world and certainly destroy the Soviet Union. So that's the only reason he withheld from war. So people like who joined CND and so on were what Lenin famously called useful idiots. But I don't think there was massive collaboration at that time. But again, I wouldn't like to, well, I don't think so, but I don't wish to pronounce on it because I only do so about things that I've studied properly.
Okay, well, look, we've been talking about your book, Stalin's Vengeance, The Final Truth About the Forced Return of Cossacks After World War II. You've done lots of other stuff as well, Nikolai, including obviously Stalin's Secret War. You mentioned the victims of Yalta. Some of your books have been translated into many different languages. I wonder if you could just finally just sum up by picking out one of those books that you think that people who are fairly new to this kind of real version of history, which has been emerging over the last 20 years or so, 30 years maybe, that one of those books that you can recommend and why.
Well, I would recommend my current one. But authors always do that, of course. But nevertheless, because I've been able to get hold of evidence which was previously unavailable to me, not just the Russian evidence, which is crucial, but also in the American archives, which, of course, are much freer than British ones have been. I think they're a bit better now in Britain. And so I was able to discover and document everything. And there's nothing in my book which isn't documented from contemporary documents. And I was also in a position 50 or 30 years ago to interview a very large number of survivors of all nationalities who were involved. And so really what I would say about my book is that always research continues, and I'm the first to know that there will be new evidence.
But yes, I'm sorry, but you haven't quite answered my question there, because we're definitely talking about your Stalin's Vengeance book, your most recent one. But I want you to recommend one of your bigger picture books, Stalin's Secret War, Victims of Yalta, or one of the other books, and explain why you think that would be a good place to start in your back catalogue.
Yes, I'm sorry, but I see what you mean. Without doubt, it would be Victims of Yalta, because that isn't dated. I mean, I would have to add or correct a little, but not much. And that gives the broad picture of the Russians handed over from Norway right down to North Africa, who were handed over, as I say, we handed over about 2.25 million of them to a certain death. As Macmillan himself said, and didn't seem to be worried about it, to send them back to Stalin was condemning them to slavery, torture, and probably death. He was open about it, unlike some people, and thought it quite clever. He was one of those people who, a bit like Boris Johnson, who think they're clever when they're outwitting other people. But as most of us don't tell lies, we're not actually very impressed.
Okay, so that's The Victims of Yalta by Nikolai Tolstoy. Also, when you talk about Yalta, I cannot help but think about the death of General Sikorsky. He was the Polish leader in exile in Britain. He was very much loved by the Polish people. And there have been all sorts of theories about why he died. I know his MI6 aide, it was one of the first times he'd ever not travelled on the same aircraft when Sikorsky died in Gibraltar. So have you any insights into what really happened there?
No, to be honest, I haven't. I know about it, of course, but I don't have any insights. And I think the trouble is all these things are well worth investigating, but some of them really one has to resort to conjecture. And if I can, as an historian, if I can avoid pure conjecture, I do, because finding evidence is everything. As far as
I mean, it was just incredible that Sikorsky, who was basically sold out at Yalta. His the whole reason for Britain joining the Second World War, starting the Second World War, was supposed to be over Poland, and yet at Yalta, Poland was sold off effectively to the Soviet Union.
You're absolutely right. And they even went, I mean, such a mean-minded gesture as not allowing brave Poles who'd fought all the way through the war on our side, they were not allowed to take part in the victory parade in London. It's an absolute disgrace. And many British soldiers of all ranks were utterly horrified by that.
Yeah, and I remember chatting with Major Tony Hibbert, retired, a few years ago. He's died now from the Battle of Arnhem. He was a brigade major on the bridge at Arnhem, and in the 1st Airborne Division. And he told me that the blaming of Polish General Szoszabowski for some of the problems at Arnhem was absolutely appalling, because it was our own generals that put him in the wrong place, and that this was really one of the most disgraceful episodes ever in the British Army's history, trying to blame the Poles. And there seemed to be a kind of almost a hate campaign. But anyway, look, that's a whole other story. Maybe we can go there another time. But anyway, Nikolai Tolstoy, author of Stalin's Vengeance, The Final Truth About the Forced Return of Cossacks After World War II, just out in 2022. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Tony.